Okay, thank you, Daniele. Thank you, Federico, for organising this. And it's great to actually meet Lisa and Alison, who I'd not met before today. So what I'm going to do is actually tell you some stories about the work I'm doing on Foucault, this early Foucault project that I'm working on, which is a book I'm writing on how Foucault came to write and then defend the history of madness in 1961. And I'm going back to all of the traces that I can find, and very few of them published, about how Foucault was doing that work, because there's only a few publications that Foucault does in the 1950s, but what Foucault published was only a fraction of what he wrote, and certainly a fraction of what he did in that period. And while most books on Foucault begin with the history of madness, this book is the end of the book, is the history of madness. So I'm trying to write everything before the history of madness in Foucault's career. So there isn't time for me to talk about the entire manuscripts that exist from that period that are in the main Paris archive at the Bibliothèque Nationale. And Daniele is part of the team of people that are editing a series of either lecture courses or manuscripts from that period. I'm not going to talk about those. I have talked about them a little bit here before at the Warwick Continental Philosophy event last June. Instead, I'm going to talk about a few smaller issues and mainly about what I've found about those issues by looking at places other than the Bibliothèque Nationale archive, so other archival traces that I've found. So I'm going to say a little bit about Foucault's practical work in psychiatry, the work he did at the Sainte-Anne Hospital and the Fresnes prison in the 1950s, a little bit about his engagement with Ludwig Binswanger's work, to mention a 1957 lecture on anthropology that he gave, and the question of what was the title of Foucault's secondary thesis. So those are the four things I'm going to say something about. All of those are stories that are told in the biographies by particularly David Macy and Didier Erebon, but I think the accounts that they tell, there's some details that I think we can change now in the light of what I've found in archives, or at least we can add more nuance into the stories about those. So Foucault began his teaching career at the École Normale Supérieure shortly after he'd after he passed the aggregation exam in the 1950s. And he did this first in parallel with being a research student at the Fondation Thiers in Paris. But he left the Fondation after a year to take up a teaching post in Lille. And then for the next few years, he taught both in Lille and in Paris and often used the same material in the two places. But at the same time, quite how he had time to do all of this, but at the same time, he was doing practical research work in hospitals and at the Fresnes prison just outside Paris. And he did that practical work because of his links to two people, really, to Jean Delay and to Georges and Jacqueline Verdeaux, particularly to Jacqueline Verdeaux. Jean Delay had actually treated Foucault as a patient when Foucault had his own depressive episodes and suicide attempts. He was referred to Delay, I think, by Louis Althusser. But then Delay, as well as treating Foucault, also employed him, which is a kind of a strange process. Jacqueline Verdeaux he knew because of his childhood. Jacqueline Verdeaux had spent the war in the safety of Poitiers with her brother and had worked as an assistant anaesthetist to Foucault's father, Dr. Paul Foucault, who was a medical practitioner, a surgeon. So then Verdeaux knows Foucault from the childhood, and then when Verdeaux and Foucault are back in Paris in the 1950s, she uses Foucault in terms of this clinical work that she and her husband, Georges Verdeaux, were doing. Now, Erebon and Macy both base their accounts of this period on interviews with Georges and Jacqueline Verdeaux, and which is clearly an invaluable account in terms of a first-person reference to this. But there are other sources, I think, for what was going on there. The Staatsarchive in Thurgau in Frauenfeld in Switzerland has the papers of Roland Kuhn, who was a psychologist who ran a clinic at Münsterlingen in Switzerland and knew the Verdeaux couple from 1947. There's a correspondence that begins with them in 1947, which is certainly earlier than the biographies imply, the links between Verdeaux and Roland Kuhn. And as well as a correspondence between both Georges and Jacqueline Verdeaux and Kuhn, also preserved there is a big file of off-prints of articles by Georges and Jacqueline Verdeaux that were sent to Roland Kuhn. Now, when I was in this archive, I only had a limited amount of time, so I didn't take a huge amount of detailed notes on those off-prints, but I did take all of the bibliographical references so that I could follow them up at a later point. And I'm working through those pieces by Georges and Jacqueline Verdeaux, reporting on the clinical work that they were doing. And the reason that I think this is interesting is that they do actually mention Foucault at one point as being somebody who had taken part in experiments that they were doing. They were working with a new electroencephalographic machine. They were tracing brain function and seeing how this was influenced by external stimuli of various kinds, including drugs. They have one article on LSD, they have another one on prescription drugs. And in one of their articles, they report that it is Foucault that has developed a test on a tachistoscope where the subject views a series of simple or complex geometrical shapes or a series of images relating to the human body, and that the test is to see how long the shutter speed has to be for somebody to be able to actually recognize the thing that they're seeing in this, to be able to perceive and to describe them. And tellingly, the subjects of this research are described as, quote, the mentally ill, delinquents and normal subjects. So it's not difficult to see how this clinical work that Foucault's involved in relates to so many of the themes of Foucault's own later work. The obvious question of mental illness and incarceration, to the role of psychiatric expertise in the criminal system, that big project that Foucault keeps saying that he's going to do something on and comes through in some of his Collège de France lectures and seminars, and the question of the delinquent or the dangerous individual, a topic obviously that Foucault also talks about. And Foucault was also involved in building up a series of records for those people that were sentenced in the Fresno prison, medical psychiatric evaluations, sociological or social worker type reports on these people, exactly the same kinds of reports that he and his colleagues at the Collège de France compiled for the Pierre Rivière dossier that they brought out in 1973. So I think there's something interesting about the practical work Foucault's doing in the 50s that connects to some of the more academic work he does later. Now, the Kuhn archives have been in the news recently because they reveal that the clinical trials that Kuhn did at Münzelingen don't meet standards of ethical approval, certainly the ones that we would hold to today for medical experiments, but I think breaching even things in the 1950s. Many of the people that were psychiatric patients that had no idea of the drugs that they were being given, what they were for, what they were testing, and so on. And Kuhn is important because he was one of the first people, possibly the first person, to recognize the antidepressant properties of the drug imipramine, which is sometimes also known as tofranil. And this was a drug that had been initially given to him as a treatment for schizophrenia, and he treated some patients with schizophrenia and realized that it didn't do anything to help them, but it did help people that were depressed. And he was the first person certainly to publish on this work, although there's one of those traditional things about who was the first person to actually recognize this. Was this Kuhn? Was this his assistant? And so on. And Kuhn, in later years, and he did live a long time, becomes quite grumpy because he doesn't think he got proper recognition for this work. He even thinks he should have had the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this work, because this was the first antidepressant that was regularly used. But the ethics of the work sound seriously questionable in terms of what he was doing with these patients that were in this clinic. He has this huge number of people. He has Swiss pharmaceutical companies just down the road, and they're feeding him all the, you know, try this on these people, try this. Now, Foucault has no involvement in those clinical trials. I'm fairly clear about that. The trials postdate Foucault's direct links with Roland Kuhn. But they do definitely connect and, I think, incriminate the Verdot couple, because the Verdot couple were using some of these same drugs to treat their patients in the Paris hospitals later in the 1950s. Now, the biographies tell the story of how Jacqueline Verdot and Roland Kuhn came to meet in a slightly more complicated way. It was the physician and philosopher André Ombredin who had initially told Jacqueline Verdot, who was working with him, to contact Kuhn, because Ombredin wanted Kuhn to see a translation that he had done of Hermann Rorschach's book, Rorschach Tests, on psychodiagnostics. It was published in Ombredin's translation in 1947. And at the same time, this is the biography story, that Ombredin lent Verdot a copy of Kuhn's book on Rorschach tests and the phenomenology of masks. This was a book that was published in 1944. And Verdot apparently liked the book so much, she asked Roland Kuhn if she could translate it into French. And as well as agreeing, Kuhn suggested that she should also meet his colleague Ludwig Binswanger and translate some of his work. And Kuhn introduces her to Binswanger, who suggests Dream and Existence as the good introduction to his late work. Verdot agrees, and because of the challenges of the Heideggerian vocabulary, as well as the psychological vocabulary in this book, she says, well, I have this guy I know called Michel Foucault, who knows Heidegger's work, and we should bring Foucault into the translation team, and he should be involved in the translation. That translation, with Foucault's very long introduction, which is almost twice as long as the text it introduces, is published in 1954. That's the way that the story is told in the biographies. But the story doesn't quite work. And I first realized something wasn't right in this because I found a 1950 lecture that was given by Binswanger in Paris that was translated for the conference by a Monsieur Gurevitch. But for the 1951 publication of this text, the footnote says, this text has been edited in translation by the author, but also by Georges and Jacqueline Verdot. So this is in 1950, 1951, so at least 3 years before the translation of Dream in Existence. Now, Ombredin, who was both a physician and had also worked on the mental illnesses of people with multiple sclerosis, has also a doctorate in letters, and he was an aggregate in philosophy. So he's an interesting figure in this kind of network between philosophy and psychology in this time. And he'd worked with Jacqueline Verdot on a translation before, which is actually a translation from English into French of a book on the clinical application of the Rorschach test, which appeared in 1948. But the Kuhn archive shows that there was a correspondence between both Georges and Jacqueline Verdot before this, from at least 1947, and that Kuhn actually visited Paris in 1947 on their invitation, which is incidentally when he first met Gaston Bachelard, who Jacqueline Verdot knew and introduced him to. And Elisabeth de Basso, who's worked very carefully with these archives I'm talking about here, has published the correspondence between Bachelard and Kuhn, which is an interesting correspondence of that connection between a philosopher and a psychologist. And it also seems from the Kuhn-Verdot correspondence that the Verdot couple met Binswanger before that September 1950 conference in Paris. So there's a much longer story here than the very compressed one that the biographies tell. Now, on Monday, I'm going to Tübingen, which has the Binswanger archive, which might reveal a little bit more about this story, because it has correspondence both between Binswanger and Foucault, Binswanger and both Georges and Jacqueline Verdot, also with Kuhn, but also the Binswanger-Heidegger correspondence. So there's quite a lot for me to look at there. Now, a letter from Jacqueline Verdot to Kuhn reveals that she was working on her translation of his book on masks as early as January 1950. She says that she's finished translating the first half of the book and that she says, I will work on the second with renewed courage, and adds, I am slow but tenacious. Well, that's an understatement. She writes this in January 1950. Her translation doesn't actually come out until 1957. Now, a recent documentary study, Foucault Münsterlingen, which was edited by Elisabeth de Basso and Jean-François Baer, provides an enormous amount of material, some of it taken from these archives, about two visits that Foucault made to Switzerland in 1954 to visit Roland Kuhn and Ludwig Binswanger. But it's clear from these documentary sources that the links between the Verdot couple, Kuhn and Binswanger, go much further back than 1954 than this. There were some other interesting things in the Kuhn archive. The highlight for me was probably the typescript of the translation that Jacqueline Verdot and Foucault did of Dream in Existence, this Binswanger essay, and a typescript of Foucault's long introduction, which as far as I'm aware, it doesn't exist in any other archive. I've certainly not found it in Paris in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Next thing I want to talk about is this radio lecture on anthropology. In the 2011 third edition of his biography of Foucault, which is quite different from the first and second editions, which are the basis for the English translation, Didier Erebon talks about a radio lecture that Foucault gave on Radio Free Berlin in June 1957. And Erebon also discusses this briefly in his 1994 book, Michel Foucault et ses contemporains. The story is that there were a series of lectures given by French academics on this radio station that were reporting on problems and current performance of modern French science, and that Foucault gave the lecture in this series on anthropology. Now, Erebon doesn't give much of a reference in his notes to these two books. He simply gives the title and the date. He does say Foucault's lecture was on anthropology, and he says it was, to his knowledge, the first time that Foucault mentions Georges Dumézil, the historian of religion, of the linguist, the person who worked on mythology and so on. Foucault's text, Erebon says, was written in French, but was translated into German and then read by the transmission's producer on the radio show. The series was commissioned by the French classicist Jean Bollock, who was then teaching at the Free University of Berlin. Now, there's very few texts from the mid to late 1950s that are preserved in the Foucault archive. And this Foucault lecture was given when Foucault was at Uppsala, when he was directing the Maison de France and teaching at the university there. This is the period when he was writing The History of Madness. As far as I can tell, none of the lectures that Foucault gave in Uppsala, we have the titles of the lectures, and I've gone through the Uppsala course catalogues to try to work out exactly what Foucault was teaching at this time. None of these exist beyond the titles that we have of them. We don't have very many traces of what he did when he was in Warsaw and in Hamburg in the late 1950s through to the early 1960s. There is a lecture in the archive that Foucault gave almost certainly in Poland on Guillaume Apollinaire, which is a topic he did also speak about in Hamburg, but it looks like the Polish version of that lecture. But that's about the longest text I've found in the Paris archive of this. So there was this 1957 lecture by Foucault on German radio seemed to me intriguing. And there was another source for knowing about that lecture, although it took me a while before I connected these two stories. In 2015, I edited a translation of a book by Kostas Axelos, who was a Greek emigre who spent most of his life in Paris. And in that book, which is a series of pieces that were originally published in German, the final one in there is a dialogue between Axelos and John Bollock, the person who'd organised this radio series. And this was actually one of the pieces broadcasted in that series. The dialogue between Axelos and Bollock was the last one broadcast, but it says there was a sequence of lectures that included speakers, including Claude Lévi-Strauss, Paul Ricoeur, Axelos, Foucault, and then a physician, a physiologist, a geographer, and an economist. So where might this lecture, this radio lecture by Foucault, be? Well, I knew it wasn't in the Paris archive, the Bibliothèque Nationale, so Foucault hadn't kept a copy himself. I did eventually find a copy of it because it's in the John Bollock archive, which is held at the Archive Littéraire Suisse, the Swiss Literary Archive in Bern. And I wrote to them and said, I know you have this, it's in your catalogue under a French title, can you tell me anything about this? Do I have to come to Bern to look at this, or could you give me a copy? And they said, no, you need to come and look at it, but it is in French. It's not. The typescript that they actually have is in German, despite being in the catalogue under a French title. Whether the French original that Foucault wrote still exists seems to me uncertain, but this text certainly has translators mentioned. But it seems to me unlikely that Foucault actually kept a copy of this, because he didn't seem to keep anything else from that period. And so I suspect that this German typescript of the translation is the only source that we still have of what transpired on that day. Foucault begins with a discussion of the lineage of the term anthropology, and Foucault had taught on philosophical anthropology, which he understands very much as a science of man rather than modern kind of ethnography. He notes in this lecture that Foucault notes that it meant the science of man, and he discusses some of the earlier understandings. But his main examples in the lecture are Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who's a very peculiar Jesuit priest who was also a kind of amateur paleontologist and philosopher, but also Claude Lévi-Strauss on kinship and the incest taboo. Foucault briefly mentions Marcel Mauss and Emile Durkheim. And Foucault's lecture is very clearly for a general audience, and he's really just telling people about what the work that these other French thinkers have done. But he does give some sense of how his work might be building on this, and philosophical anthropology is an important theme. Of course, Foucault goes on to translate Kant's anthropology for his secondary thesis. In the conclusion, he very briefly mentions Gaston Bachelard's work, and makes a suggestion. He says, Georges de Mézières recreates the grand architecture of Indo-European myths and has therefore developed an oeuvre whose contribution to anthropology, in this philosophical sense, is much more considerable than Merleau-Ponty's speculations on the physiology and psychology of the reflex. So I think that's an interesting marker, because Merleau-Ponty was very important to Foucault in the early 1950s. Foucault attended many of Merleau-Ponty's courses, but de Mézières becomes an important figure for Foucault, both for getting him the job in Uppsala, it's de Mézières' recommendation that gets Foucault that job, but also it's clear that Foucault's starting to read and engage with de Mézières' work around this time, and I think that's important in terms of an engagement with a particularly important thinker. It's definitely the text that Erebon mentions, because a quotation Erebon gives accords directly to this manuscript. It's also the one that Axelos and Bollock are discussing in that piece I said in that edited book. The last thing I want to say something about is that secondary thesis. So Foucault presents the history of madness, but to get the doctor in letters, the state doctorate at that time, he had to present a secondary thesis, which is his translation of Kant's anthropology with that very long introduction. Foucault publishes the translation in 1964, but only has a very short, sort of about 5 pages, historical note that precedes it. The long introduction that Foucault writes is only published after Foucault's death. In that long introduction, Foucault talks about the layers that give this text by Kant, that give its geology depth. He talks about the archaeology of the text, although he says this is very difficult to do, given the basis of available evidence. At that time, Kant's lecture transcripts, which we now have all published, these were not widely available at the time Foucault was writing. And Foucault talks about these same kinds of themes in the presentation that he gave of his thesis at the thesis defence. And Foucault's notes for that thesis defence are in the Paris archive at the Bibliothèque Nationale. Foucault outlines in both the introduction and in that presentation the two registers through which he says that the text should be analysed, genetic and structural. Genetically, the work, he says, needs to be understood in relation to its development, as the text we have of the anthropology is weighed down with sedimentation having closed over the past in which it took shape. But Foucault says it can be traced back through the lecture courses that Kant gave over several decades on both anthropology and geography. Structurally, Foucault says it can be situated within Kant's work as a whole, both in terms of the overall organisation of Kant's work and in particular relation to the critical work. If you read the anthropology and geography lectures, over time they change as Kant moves from the so-called pre-critical work to the critical work. There are changes in the way that Kant lectures on these. Later, Foucault calls this relation historical and structural, a problem, he says, that is apparent both in the chronology of the text and in the architectonics of Kant's oeuvre. Now, this twofold genetic and structural approach to a text very clearly relates to the way that Jean Hippolyte had approached Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. Hippolyte's famous book on the phenomenology is called The Genesis and Structure of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. And Jean Hippolyte, of course, was the rapporteur for this secondary thesis. He'd said that he couldn't be the rapporteur for Foucault's primary thesis on madness, which is why Georges Congrian gets involved, but he will be the rapporteur for this thesis on Kant. So, Genesis and Structure of Hegel's Phenomenology, and people have been suggesting for many years that Foucault's introduction to his translation of Kant's Anthropology was indeed called The Genesis and Structure of Kant's Anthropology. It's a claim that's made by two people that I almost always defer to on these questions. Didier Erebon and Daniel Defer, among others, make that claim. But the archival copies do not substantiate this. There's a photocopy of the Sorbonne version, the version of record. Foucault submitted it to the Sorbonne as part of that formal process of getting his doctoral thesis. There's a photocopy of that at IMEC, the Contemporary French Archive in Normandy. I've also seen the copy in Jean Hippolyte's archive, so the rapporteur for this thesis. I've also seen the copy in Georges Congiem's archive, so the rapporteur for the other thesis. Foucault's own copy of the thesis, which is in the Bibliothèque Nationale, unfortunately is missing the first few pages, including the cover. But none of the other copies, the version of record in the Sorbonne, the version that Hippolyte had and the version that Congrian have, all have the simple title Introduction to Kant's Anthropology. They don't substantiate this story of what it was actually titled. But just to make sure I check down every version I can find, there is a version at the Sorbonne which I'm going to try and look at just in case there's a difference between that and the photocopy at EMEC, but that's really dotting the I's on this. I'm pretty convinced that it just has a simple vanilla title of Introduction to Kant's Anthropology. So, a few things, a few stories about the work I've been doing that's using the archives. The main Paris archive, the Bibliothèque Nationale, is huge and vast, and I'm using it enormously for the work I'm doing. It's incredibly valuable. But I'm increasingly realising there's a lot of information in other places that I think adds into this story that I'm trying to tell. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Stuart.